From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Kelly McEvers. In this episode, we go to California's Venice Beach to test the economic theory that people are better off when they live in an area that has mixed incomes.
If you're from a poor background, you don't want to be in an area where the poor are segregated from the rest of the population.
William T. Volman talks to us about his new collection called Last Stories and Other Stories.
I'm hoping to die from a heart attack or a stroke and not go through this.
And we look at the life of Tommy Ramone, the last living member of the punk band The Ramones, who died this past week. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. In Iraq, relations between the Shiite-led government in Baghdad and Kurdish leaders in the north have soured. That's ever since Sunni extremist militants seized huge portions of the country, including nearly the entire border with the Kurdish north. Kurds have pulled out of the central government altogether, and regional authorities are making plans to hold a referendum on independence from Iraq. At the same time, violence continues throughout the country. Just yesterday, there were reports that gunmen in Baghdad raided an apartment building and killed at least 29 people, including 25 women. NPR's Layla Fadel is in Erbil. That's a Kurdish city in northern Iraq. And Layla, what were the details of this incident in Baghdad overnight?
We spoke to a security official that said it was a Shia militia that raided the building and basically shot all of these people overnight. And from what we understand, the militia has been going after women that they deem to be prostitutes. And it's sort of as a reminder of the past in 2006 and 2007 when Shia militias ran rampant in the streets killing Sunni men and anybody they deemed to be a sinner or not with them.
So how is this connected to the recent advances of Sunni extremist forces?
Well, these militias were reactivated, basically, in Baghdad in order to battle the Sunni extremists. So it's really becoming quite a sectarian war, Shia militias against Sunni extremist militants. And that's really how these militias are back on the streets, running freely, people with guns, and a lot of residents saying we don't know who is who.
Now the violence in Iraq has also increased political tensions. I mean, what can you tell us about this rift between the central government in Baghdad and the Kurds in the north, and where you are?
Well, Kurds have long aspired to have their own independent state. And after the Islamic State, which is this extremist Sunni group that has declared a caliphate in parts of Iraq and Syria, took swaths of the country, Kurds went into disputed territory abandoned by the Iraqi army and took it because they believe it's part of their ultimate state. That includes the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, oil fields. And this has caused much hostility between the Shia-led government in Baghdad and the Kurdish authorities up here. Maliki, instead of asking for help from the Kurdish authorities to fight extremism, has accused the Kurds of hosting terrorists and enemies of the state inside their borders. And the Kurds reacted, saying, well, then we're not going to participate in your government, pulling their ministers, saying that Maliki should get out. Baghdad cut the budget to Kurdistan prior to all of this happening and now is stopping cargo flights, and there's really no longer any connection between the central government and the Kurdish authorities up here.
Wow. So does this mean Iraq is breaking apart? I mean, does it look like the Kurds will end up with their dream, after all, their own independent country?
Yeah, I think we're watching Iraq splintering. And the thing I hear most in the Kurdish north is that Iraq today will never be Iraq pre-Mosul, meaning pre-last month when the Islamic State came into Iraq and took Mosul, took Nineveh province and other Sunni Arab areas. They're saying, after this seizure, they can't trust the central government. They have to think about themselves. And Maliki's actions are pushing them further towards an independent state rather than towards the central government.
That's NPR's Layla Fadel in the Kurdish north in the city of Erbil. Layla, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Germany has won the World Cup final in Brazil. They beat Argentina 1-0 in overtime. NPR's Tom Goldman was at the stadium and is on the line from Rio de Janeiro. Hey, Tom.
Kelly, how are you? I hope you can hear me okay. I hear from Maracanã Stadium in Rio. There are some crazy Germans marauding here.
It sounds like you're having a terrible time. I mean, this was a nail-biter of a game. It was tied 0-0 for most of the time, and then
you know, Germany finally scores way late in the game. Tell us about that goal.
Yeah, we had gone 113 minutes without a goal. And you know what, Kelly? You can go that long and actually have an exciting game. And we did. It was a really good game. But then suddenly, with about 7 minutes left in the second extra time, 22-year-old reserve forward Mario Götze, remember that name? He's a World Cup hero. He got loose near the Argentina goal. He took a beautiful pass from a teammate who made a run down the left side of the field and then lofted this perfect pass. And Götze controlled it with his chest and then kicked it in left-footed. That was it. World Cup hero, instant hero. It's amazing.
Yeah, and what were some of the other highlights from the match?
Kelly, there weren't many. We went 113 minutes without a score. I mean, both teams got their chances, and soccer insiders will tell you, no, it was a good game. It was a very hard-nosed game, very defensive game. Anytime anyone got loose near the other team's goal, you know, the defense would be there to snuff it out. So very hard fought and incredibly disappointing for Argentina, which, you know, really slowed this German juggernaut, which had rolled into the final after that now infamous 7-1 drubbing of host country Brazil in the semifinal.
Yeah, and it was especially disappointing for Argentina's star, Lionel Messi. I mean, a lot of people think he's like the best player in the world, but I mean, you know, what happened today?
Yeah, he is considered the best player in the world. He's a dynamite player, and he's been fantastic for his club, Barcelona. He's never really pulled it off, though, for the national team, playing for Argentina. And this was his big chance. And, you know, he just couldn't do it. Late in the game, he got a free kick, one of his specialties. He's able to bend the ball into the net as well as anyone. And he took the shot and skied it over the German goal, and that was really Argentina's last best shot. He won the Golden Ball Award for the most outstanding player, and you have never seen anyone win an award like that and look so upset.
Oh.
He walked down the receiving line with all these dignitaries, and he barely even made eye contact with them.
Oh, that's hard to watch. But it sounds like there are a lot of people who are happy tonight. That's NPR's Tom Goldman on the line from Rio. Tom, thanks so much.
You bet, Kelly.
If you've ever been to Southern California, you've probably visited or at least heard about Venice Beach. A funky beach town where about 16 million people come to visit every year. A part of LA that's somehow different from the other upscale developments along the coast. A spot for surfers, skateboarders, street vendors, and homeless people. But these days, that's changing. I moved to Venice earlier this year, and I recently went on the Venice Garden and Home Tour. At one point, I was standing on top of a piece of property that was probably worth several million dollars.
So you're standing up here at this penthouse. You can just look right out over the ocean. You can also look right out over the Venice Boardwalk. And just below here is a grassy area where people live and sleep.
Like so many neighborhoods in U.S. cities, Venice was pretty dicey in the 80s and 90s, and now it's gentrifying. Think Williamsburg in Brooklyn, the Mission in San Francisco, the near northwest side of Chicago. You know what I mean.
There are two bedrooms to your left. Step toward them, but not fully in them.
Now the median income in Venice is rising fast, and a lot of the homes on the tour are like this.
Okay, so here's the spiel. 1915 original structures, front and back. Most of the furniture is original.
When people in American cities talk about change and gentrification in these areas, it's sometimes seen as a bad thing. Poor people get pushed out, the argument goes, and greedy developers move in. But recent economic studies show that if a neighborhood has poor people, middle-income people, and wealthy people all living together, the people on the lower end have a better shot at moving up. That mix of people is called economic diversity. But the question is how to maintain that diversity. And that's our cover story today.
And the ancient world was in my reach from my room and house on Venice Beach. Room and house on Venice Beach.
Wow. Let's start with the data. For the past several years, a group of economists from Harvard, UC Berkeley, and the U.S. Treasury have been working on a landmark study on economic mobility. The idea was to ask if America really is the land of opportunity, if people really do better than their parents. What they found is this varies widely from place to place. Cities with more upward mobility tend to have good schools, stable families, greater social capital, and economic diversity. So does that mean you have a better chance at getting ahead if you live with people who are doing better than you?
Short answer is yes.
That's Nathan Hendren, one of the Harvard economists on the study. He says places with economic and racial segregation, basically where poor minorities are separated from everyone else, have some of the lowest rates of economic mobility. Cities like Atlanta, Charlotte, and Milwaukee, the study found.
If you're from a poor background, you don't want to be in an area where the poor are segregated from the rest of the population. Across the U.S., areas where rich and poor live together tend to have higher rates of mobility than areas where the poor and the rich are segregated.
So far, the research is just at the city level. Hendren says the team is looking at breaking it down further. But what we do know is that it's good to be in a mixed area. So we decided to test the idea in Venice.
Hi, how are you doing?
We went to see Tamika Donaldson. She makes about $50,000 a year as a nurse's assistant and supports her two teenage kids. She lives in a low-income apartment building in Venice, literally blocks from the beach and the hipster restaurants.
So how many bedrooms is this?
Two.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Tamika says she and the kids used to live on a street in another part of the city where everyone around them was poor. But she didn't like it, so she applied for new housing. 7 years ago, a woman with a nonprofit housing organization matched Tamika with a subsidized apartment in Venice.
And I was like, well, the place is too small. And she kind of was like, well, you sacrificing space, but you basically going to get, you know, the diversity and different cultures living in the neighborhood.
Tamika finally gave in. The apartment's so small, she has to sleep on the floor in the living room with one teenager in each bedroom. But she says it's worth it. Tamika says she gets more exercise in Venice, walking and biking on the beach. There are more services, clinics, tenant groups, job training, and after-school programs for the kids. She says her son took a photography class and sold his stuff at an auction. She says living around people who are doing better makes her and the kids feel more confident.
I think that it helps to keep kids motivated, you know, because kids, they want things and they see things. And maybe if they see, you know, people around them having things, maybe it'll make them try a little bit harder. That's what I hope.
Of course, not all low-income families in L.A. have the option to move to Venice, like Tamika. In fact, many low-income families who live in Venice are being pushed out. The law says there's a limit on how much you can raise someone's rent. But tenants groups told us landlords do all kinds of things, like not fixing apartments. So old tenants will move out and new tenants who have to pay market rate will move in. Middle class tenants just get priced out. Mike Bonin rented a place in Venice for 18 years.
When it was time to buy a house, when I got out of my 30s, couldn't afford Venice.
Now, Bonin serves on the Los Angeles City Council, representing Venice and the surrounding neighborhoods. We went to see him at his office. Bonin says he worries that as Venice develops, it will lose its economic diversity.
There's very little the city can do to wave a magic wand to say that economic developments are going to stay frozen in time and rents are going to stay frozen in time and
sure.
Property values are going to stay frozen
right.
In time.
But Bonin says there are things the city can do to mitigate that.
We can certainly build more affordable housing. We can certainly do a much better job of preserving the affordable housing that's there. And we can certainly do a better job of making sure that the affordable housing that is being required to be built is maintained and kept and being used as affordable housing.
Bonin says developers might say they're building affordable housing, but there's little way to enforce that. He says there is one other thing that gives him hope.
There's so many folks who are moving in. They're sort of entrepreneurial and they're problem solvers by nature.
You mean the techies?
Yeah, a lot of the techies. And they're like, well, you know, how can we help? And they're not wedded to a worldview when they come into it. They're like, all right, how do we fix this?
So many tech companies are coming to Venice. They're starting to call it Silicon Beach. Google's LA office is in Venice and is now doing a big expansion. Other companies like Snapchat are there too. Most diehard Venetians are skeptical these young entrepreneurs will do much to help the neighborhood stay mixed. But Bonin says he's pushing them to tweak existing programs to create things like an Airbnb for low-income housing. That Harvard study we talked about shows that American cities that have only very rich people and very poor people do not have good economic mobility. Bonin says the question is whether Venice becomes one of these places or remains a mixed place where someone like Tamika can have a better life. Here's a name you might have heard in the news this week, Bill Hillman. For the last 10 years, this guy from Chicago has joined the annual Running of the Bulls in Pamplona, Spain. And going into this week, he'd always made it out okay. So far, so good. Until Wednesday, when Bill was, you know, running with the bulls as usual, and a bull gored him in the thigh. Here's the thing. Bill Hillman also co-wrote a book called Fiesta, How to Survive the Bulls of Pamplona. So given his issue with the bull this week, a lot of people thought, well, that was kind of ironic. Someone who reviewed the book on Amazon even said, looking forward to his new book, A Guide to the Best Urgent Care Facilities in Pamplona. So we decided to go to the source. We called up Bill and reached him in his hospital room. Bill Hillman, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be on.
Can you tell us how you're feeling?
You know, I'm feeling good. My body feels fine. They got me on some really good painkillers, so I'm just kind of floating here on the hospital bed.
So tell me exactly how this went down. You were running at the time. What happened?
Well, I ran with the pack at first, and the pack sort of passed me, and I sort of shrugged it off, but I looked back, and there was one bull that had been separated from the pack, and it was left. And when that happens, the bull loses its herding instinct, and it decides just to gore everything in its sight. It's the most dangerous situation in the run, but it's something that I love. It's my favorite bull to run with is a suelto.
It's called a suelto? What does that mean?
Yeah. Suelto means a loose one,
yeah.
A loose bull.
Okay.
I just kind of ease in towards him slowly and carefully. And when I get close, the bull instantly sort of acknowledged me and approached me. So I at that moment, I figured I was going to run this bull all the way into the arena, which was about 80 yards. But I put my hand out behind me, and I felt another runner behind me. And that run, when I looked back, that runner yelled at me and pushed me. And I was like, whoa, that is not normal. Like, why is that guy doing that? And the bull came, and he sort of charged when he saw the commotion. Then the guy pushed me even harder, and this time I fell. And when I fell, the bull fell. And as the bull fell, he gored me in the thigh and lifted me up and threw me. There was no pain whatsoever. It was just that I felt like I'd just been picked up and moved. And I crawled out on my back. The bull sort of tried to get me a couple more times as I was crawling out. A medic who was on the other side of the fencing, he drug me out the rest of the way. And I looked down, and there was about a racquetball-sized hole in my thigh. And there was another hole in my thigh, sort of under my thigh, like under my kneecap, sort of. And that was the exit wound of the horn. I started thinking, okay, I might be dying. And I was just kind of amazed by that for some reason. I was just astonished by that idea that I could be dying right now.
Oh.
But they started to work on me. I asked them, like, is it the artery? They sort of looked and kept working, and then they stopped. They said, no, it's just the muscle. You're fine.
So do you think it was that other runner's fault that made this happen?
Oh, yeah. No question.
What was he doing? I mean, why did he do that?
My running friends have all been looking at the photos to try to identify the runners, and it appears to be three English tourists who were panicking and didn't know what to do and were freaking out, and in the panic, they pushed me.
You know, you've been doing this for a while now, and now this pretty terrible, you know, this pretty intense thing has happened. I have to ask you, is your family saying, okay, that's enough, time to stop?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they've been saying it for years, you know.
So are you going to, are you going to listen to them this time?
No, I'm not. It's a very important part of my life, and I'm going to continue.
I mean, one of the reasons people have taken to this story, of course, it's the reason that we're calling, is that, you know, you wrote part of a book called Fiesta, How to Survive the Bulls of Pamplona. I mean, how is that irony sitting with you today?
Well, I mean, I have a problem with it because I don't see it as an irony at all. I'm alive. I survived.
That's right. All right. Fair enough.
I don't see it as irony at all. Gorings are part of the run. And if you run long enough, you get gored. Most people see it as a badge of honor. You know, I don't know if I feel that strongly about it. You know, I wish I wasn't gored, for example. I mean, I'm not glad I got gored at all. You know, at the same time, you know, I know when I step in the street that this is part of it.
If you run long enough, you're going to get gored. Words to live by from Bill Hillman. He's also the author of a new novel called The Old Neighborhood. We reached him in the hospital where he's recuperating after being gored by a bull. Bill, thanks. Take care.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
The Colorado River starts in the Rocky Mountains, and for more than 1,400 miles, it wends its way south. Along the way, it's dammed and diverted dozens of times to cities and fields all over the American West. But drought and the tens of millions of people who depend on that river are sucking it dry. This week, the reservoir that supplies Las Vegas, Lake Mead, reached its lowest level in history. By the time the Colorado River reaches the U.S.-Mexico border, only 10% of it is left. At that point, it hits a place called the Morelos Dam and is diverted a final time into Mexican farmland. In other words, Morelos is where you go to see the Colorado River die. Rowan Jacobson is a writer who recently was at the Morelos Dam when something pretty astounding happened. He says that on one side of the dam, it's this lush, green place, and on the other,
it's a surreal landscape. You look south and you just see a trench. Big stretches of it are bone dry. It is just a river of sand at this point. So you just see the riverbed filled with white sand like you'd find at the beach. And that's all that's left of what used to be a vast delta with about 2 million acres of wetlands.
Wow. So then recently, Mexican and American officials agreed and decided to lift the Morelos Dam and let some water flow into that parched riverbed. Why?
It was 15 years in the works, and it's a complicated arrangement. There's a lot of pieces to it. But one part that everyone came to agree on is that it would be a great thing to let a bunch of water go down the traditional channel purely for ecological restoration, which was the first time the U.S. and Mexican governments have done anything like that.
And so you were there when they lifted the dam. Tell us where exactly you were when that happened.
I was directly below the dam, which in retrospect was probably a fairly stupid place to be.
Yeah.
But I wasn't alone. There was maybe a couple hundred of us there. So the gate opened and this little surge came out and we all cheered and we popped some champagne. And then we realized the surge was a bit bigger than we had expected. So pretty quick we had to scramble up a bank to get away from it. But that was a good sign because this was going to be a full-blown river, at least for a few weeks.
So they lift the dam slowly. It starts to look like, wow, this is going to be a river. What was your plan?
We pulled together a small band of river rats and paddle boards.
I mean, this is basically standing on a surfboard and paddling your way through.
Yeah, all day long. The first 22 miles, it actually forms the border with Arizona. So we would be paddling, and we could see the Border Patrol guys off to the side occasionally when the river would curve through there. And they were a little freaked out by the whole situation.
So as you followed the path of the water down, how were people reacting to the fact that this river was coming back after being gone for decades?
Yeah, you know, the end of our first day, we came into this town called San Luis Rio Colorado, which was always a river town until the water dried up. So us and the water arrived in this town that hadn't seen water in decades.
Wow.
And the party had started already. All the kids were waiting there, and the kids started splashing in the water, cranking up the ranchero music, and it was just a huge fiesta.
So water from the Colorado River eventually did reach the sea all the way to the Gulf of California. What's going to happen now? Is that water going to keep flowing?
No, it's done. It was shut off in May. Enough water has been purchased to basically keep a trickle going for the next 5 years to try to keep these trees alive. But it's just a trickle.
I mean, because I think we have to say that we are here in the West in the middle of a major drought. I mean, how can you make the case that this particular project needs water over some other, you know, more bigger agricultural projects, you know, obviously cities that need water?
It's super controversial, and a lot of people think this was about the dumbest thing you possibly could have done with the water. But, you know, 50 times as much water as was released for this project is used for irrigation to make alfalfa, basically, to feed cattle. So if we can just take 1/50th of the water that we use to make hamburgers and milk from the Colorado River, we can have this kind of event every year.
That's Rowan Jacobson. His story about the undamming of the Colorado River in Morelos, Mexico, is in this month's issue of Outside Magazine. Rowan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kelly.
You You might know Karen Parsons as that airhead princess, Hillary Banks, from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Dad, I need $300.
Hillary, your cousin Will is here.
Hi. Dad, I need $300.
Today, Karen Parsons has a different priority. She runs an organization called Sweet Blackberry, producing short animated films for children about influential yet little-known African Americans. When I spoke to her earlier this week, she said the idea started many years ago.
My mother was a librarian, and she would call me from time to time with interesting stories that she came across. She shared with me one day the story of Henry Box Brown, a slave who had literally mailed himself to freedom in a box from Virginia to Pennsylvania. None of my friends had heard the story either. And I thought, that's crazy. How come we don't know about this guy? So I started making notes about it. And I would put it aside and then come back. And when I was pregnant with my daughter many years later, I started to really think about my responsibility as a parent supplementing my child's education. What do I want her to learn? What do I need to bring to her on my own? And finally, I arrived at Sweet Blackberry.
I've come very far. Still, no man is free unless we all are.
So your first film was about Henry Box Brown, and then the second film you made was about an inventor.
Yeah, Garrett Morgan, I mean, is a fascinating man. This is the inventor of the traffic signal, as well as a gas mask and a bunch of other things.
And suddenly he jumped up and exclaimed, I've got it. A traffic signal.
Our focus on Garrett's gift is on the traffic signal, because also our age group, you know, we have really little kids. That's something that they're learning about and navigating.
And now you're raising money to do a new one about a ballerina named Janet Collins. Who was she?
Janet Collins was the first African-American prima ballerina. At 15 years old, in 1932, she was asked by the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo to join their dance troupe, which was just unprecedented at the time for a black dancer to be asked. The condition would be that she would have to perform in whiteface.
Huh.
So she was devastated, but she still said no. Instead, she worked extra hard, and she would end up becoming the first black prima ballerina and the first black soloist at the Metropolitan Opera.
Hmm.
In schools, we learn about a handful of stories, great stories, but still, we're missing out on so much. We want to celebrate black history, but we don't want to separate it from American history. We've been fortunate enough to bring Chris Rock on to narrate the Janet Collins story, and we have a Kickstarter campaign right now. We're in our last week, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to bring my Fresh Prince family on.
Mm.
Everybody's kicking in to do it.
Many people remember you as Hillary Banks on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's almost 20 years since then. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how we got here. What have you been doing over the years?
Yeah. Nothing. I continued acting for a while after The Fresh Prince, but I had two kids. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
I became a mom. I
have an honorable profession.
Wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yep.
That's my everything, really. I've never stopped loving acting. It's just, you know, my perspective has changed and my priorities have changed. And that's what I've just been working on.
Karen Parsons is the founder of Sweet Blackberry. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Karen.
Thank you very much.
Come here. Look. New spring grass.
It's summer. Kids are out of school, going to the movies. I don't know about you, but I remember exactly where I was when I learned that Bambi's mom had been killed. That movie theater in Anna, Illinois, sitting near the front, crying my face off.
Bambi, quick. The thicket.
But think about it. Bambi was just the beginning. A lot of animated films have dead moms. Just ask Sarah Boxer.
Chicken Little, The Fox and Hound, Beauty and the Beast, Nemo, Despicable Me, the kids start out as orphans, Lilo's mother and father both killed in a car crash, Coda's mother in Brother Bear, Po's mother in Kung Fu Panda 2, Ariel's mother crushed by a pirate ship in Little Mermaid, I think 3, and Ice Age.
Boxer is a graphic novelist, a critic, and a lover of cartoons. She's also a mom. She first noticed all these dead mothers when she started watching kids' movies with her 10-year-old son.
One of the things I love about animated movies is that you can basically create any fantasy that you want. And what's striking to me is that over and over you get this world without mothers. And as a mother myself, I sort of take offense.
Boxer says the dead mother theme has actually been around since long before Bambi. From ancient Chinese folktales to the Brothers Grimm to Dickens, dead moms seem to be everywhere in fiction. So why?
Bruno Bettelheim, he's a child psychologist, and he wrote a whole book about the Grimm stories and fairy tales in general and how you have to kill off the mother to have a really good plot, to have an adventure story, basically. If the mother's there, there is no story. It's just a, you know, well-adjusted child growing up.
Sometimes, though, there is a surprising variation.
For instance, take The Lion King. In that one, actually, the mother survives and the father dies.
Long live the king.
But I think the difference in something like The Lion King, where the father dies, is it becomes a major plot point. So I think it's very different where the mother dies and sort of is swept out of the way in order that the plot can begin, which has basically nothing to do with the mother.
Boxer has noticed another trend in kids' movies, too. Used to be evil stepmothers took the place of dead moms. Now, somebody else is stepping in.
This is the perfect father. And not only a good parent in the maternal sense of being protective, but also kind of a buddy, you know, a playmate, somebody who's...
A bro.
A bro, exactly, as in bro bear. The truth is, most families have two parents. And there are like four times as many single mother-led families as single father-led families. But I do think that there is an underlying message that is also coming across, which is that, you know, we don't really need mothers. In fact, life might be kind of more fun without them. They're not, you know, calling us down to supper and telling us to clean our rooms or whatever, that it could be a life of pure adventure.
As a mother, that message worries Boxer, especially because kids are watching these movies during their early formative years. She says families might want to look at movies like The Incredibles, where mom, dad, and the kids were all part of the adventure. Sarah Boxer's article is called Why Are All the Cartoon Mothers Dead? It's in this month's Atlantic.
3, 2, 1. We have ignition. And liftoff of NASA's New Horizons.
In January 2006, the New Horizons spacecraft left Earth on a 3 billion mile journey to Pluto and the farthest depths of our solar system. This trip takes a long time, like 9.5 years. And guess what? We're almost there. So mark your calendars. A year from tomorrow, it'll finally reach its destination. Here's NPR's Priska Neely.
I've been interested in Pluto since I was little. For a pretty simple reason. Like my name, it starts with a P.
Well, that's one reason. My name starts with an A, and I'm interested in Pluto.
Alan Stern is more than interested. He's the principal investigator for the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Planning for this mission started almost 25 years ago, and Stern has been there since the beginning. Next year, on July 14th, Stern and his team will finally see that close encounter. They chose that date back in 2001.
Not only did we choose the date, by the way, we chose the hour and the minute, and we're on track. We're arriving at Pluto on the morning of the 14th of July, 2015. It's Bastille Day. To celebrate, we're storming the gates of Pluto.
But let me be clear. This is an unmanned, flyby mission by a spacecraft about the size and shape of a baby grand piano. No humans or robots will be landing and walking around.
Arriving's a little bit of a squishy term, I know. At closest approach, we'll be about 6,000 miles from Pluto.
That distance was carefully calculated to make sure they could get the sharpest images and avoid being pulled into Pluto's orbit. 6,000 miles away is still way closer than we've ever been.
The closest any spacecraft had ever been to Pluto was ridiculously far, about 1 billion miles. And we've been within 1 billion miles of Pluto for years now, and so every day we break our own record.
The best images of Pluto so far are from the Hubble telescope. By May of next year, The New Horizons spacecraft will beat that.
We actually call that our BTH date, better than Hubble.
By the way, in case you're wondering, the New Horizons team didn't plan on the whole thing where Pluto was demoted to a dwarf planet the same year as the launch, but that didn't change anything for Alan Stern.
I always think of Pluto as a planet.
Some planetary scientists still dispute Pluto's planet status. And either way, Stern says missions like this always turn up surprises.
When we first sent missions to Jupiter, no one expected to find moons that would have active volcanoes. And I could go down a long list of how many times we've been surprised by the richness of nature.
And so now, we wait.
You'll just have to wait, just like we will, to unwrap this present. Save the date, July 14th, 2015, humankind's encounter with Pluto.
The New Horizons spacecraft is healthy and full of fuel. So after that, it'll keep going, exploring beyond Pluto into the outer rim of our solar system. Priska Neely, NPR News.
For the week ending July 13th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Stephen Jackson, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Kelly McEvers. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.